Hello, and welcome to the fourth and this year's final episode of a podcast series featuring the NIDDK's Urologic Diseases in America Report. Join Drs. Brian Matlaga and Ryan C. as they share insights into diagnostics, therapeutic options, and treatment outcomes for urinary stone disease.
Hello, my name is Brian Matlaga. I'm a professor of urology at Johns Hopkins University, and I also serve as one of the principal investigators for the Urologic Diseases in America project. And I'm very excited to be speaking with you today through this platform that this partnership with the American Urological Association has provided us. And today what we'll be reviewing is another condition that we've studied in the Urologic Diseases in America project, this one being kidney stones. And joining us on this podcast, I'm very excited to introduce Dr. Ryan C., who's an assistant professor at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, who has also devoted his both academic as well as clinical career to the treatment of patients with urinary stone disease. And so, Ryan, thank you for joining on this podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank the AUA and the Urologic Diseases in America project for inviting me.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited to be joining you. And what we'll do is probably over the next 15 to 20 minutes, we'll go through really what we consider to be, if you want to call them highlights or kind of important aspects of what we found when we looked through the kidney stones data sets. And we looked at a number of data sets in this project. We looked at NHANES, which is the National Health and Nutrition Survey. We looked at Optum clinical datamart, which is essentially a data set of privately insured individuals. So this represents, really a working age population. We also looked at a pediatric cohort via the Optum data. And then finally, we looked at the CMS data to understand this condition in the over 65 years of age population, and essentially the Medicare population. And Ryan and I have organized our time together really in what we think is somewhat of a logical fashion. So we'll go through, a sharing of what we found looking at prevalence data. We'll explore a little bit of what we learned with regards to diagnostics, surgical therapeutics. One of the great things that we have now with both Medicare Part D data, as well as using a data set such as the Optum private payer data set, is we have pharmacologic data or pharmaceutical utilization. And so we'll also talk a little bit about pharmacotherapy in the context of stone disease. Again, the nature of these data sets is really, they're very powerful because they also provide us some longitudinal information. So we can begin to track how patients move through the healthcare system, which is important because there's, as we all know, there's increasing emphasis on trying to understand what quality is in healthcare. And that's obviously a very complex discussion. But one of the ways we can begin to understand some aspects of quality and care is using longitudinal data via these large administrative data sets. And so we'll share some of our findings in that with regards to outcomes. And then we'll try to wrap it all together in terms of what we think, kind of the message from the NIDDK's Urologic Diseases in America project is going forward. So so I'll pause there. And Ryan, what I'll ask you to do, if you can share with us, some of the findings with regards to prevalence rates that we've seen among the stone-forming patients.
Yeah, certainly. So using these three different data sets, we get a unique view from the NHANES data set on the prevalence. As you know, that an NHANES data set is a self-reported kidney stone. And we looked at between years 2007 and 2012. And in the prior studies before this, in the 1990s and early 2000s, we found that the prevalence of stone disease risen dramatically over that time period. But during 2007, 2012, it seems to have plateaued. So That plateau seems to be very interesting. But when we look further into prevalence rates among men and women, we see a very stark difference than prior years. And here we see that among women, the prevalence dramatically increased from about 6.5% from 2007 to 2008 to about 8.9% from 2011 to 12. Whereas in men, the prevalence declined from about 11.5% to 8% in the same period. And so these dramatic changes in prevalence, we're not quite sure what is the driving forces that explain this, but we suspect there may be in part related to the changes in lifestyle, diet, increase in overweight and obesity, especially among women during the same period.
Yeah, and one other I think powerful aspect of the Urologic Diseases Project is by having access to the private payer data, we can start to look at unique populations within that we really have not had an ability to do previously. And one of those is the pediatric population. And I know because prior to my work with urologic diseases, I personally tried to get a better understanding of what is the burden of stone disease among the pediatric population, just because clinically, we were seeing more and more children with stones, and so we had a perception that there may be an increase in incidence and prevalence. And what we found when I tried to look at this is that there's really not great, or at the time, there were not great data sets. You had things like the Kids Inpatient Data Set, but again, as the name implies, that's inpatient setting data. And as we all know, most stone patients are treated not in an inpatient setting, but in an outpatient setting. And what the literature shows is there are well-done studies, but they tend to be either single institution series or from fairly specialized centers, such as freestanding children's hospitals. And there wasn't really a good set of data to try and understand what the burden of stone disease is among children. And so what we were able to do with the Urologic Diseases Project is leverage the Datamart cases and use that data set to try to better understand what the burden of stone disease is among children. And what we found through these data is that we looked at the years 2006 up to about 2016. And what we found was that if we first looked at rates, we saw that there was an increasing number of children with a diagnostic code for or with a medical code for stone disease that rose up until around the year 2011 and then plateaued and started to decline to some extent. But there was a fairly marked increase from 2005, 2006 up to through 2011. The other thing that was very interesting is that when we broke the cohorts down both by age and gender, females consistently had a higher rate of stone disease than did males. And this tended to be clustered in the teen years. And then also, white enrollees had a higher rate than other ethnic groups. And so, I think these data are important because they do show us that there was an increase in the rates of stone disease among children, which seemed to have plateaued and stabilized and then started to decline as we moved into more recent years. And it also gave us, I think, more information on which populations may be at risk so that we can begin to focus some effort to better understanding why, for example, in the teen years, or if, for example, in the female gender, how come we're seeing increased rates among that population. One other aspect that we can do if we move from prevalence into essentially diagnostics. And before I do that, I just wanted to ask Ryan, do you have any other thoughts on in the adult population, kind of what particularly struck you
Yeah, I
in
mean,
looking at this prevalence?
yeah, we also able to look at coexisting medical conditions. And we also saw that hypertension, rates of hypertension and diabetes also increased over the same period. And so we understand that many of these chronic conditions have shared risk factors, and maybe the combination of these diet and lifestyle changes across time may be contributing to both risk in adults and children.
Yeah. And I think that's something, you know, and as we, you know, towards the end of this podcast, we'll come up with, you know, kind of, I think, our take home messages. But as you're listening in, you know, I think one thing that, you know, by looking at large data sets, such as what urologic diseases can do, it can really identify new questions to ask. And that's something that I think, you know, both Brian and I will be sharing, you know, as we review these data. So as we all know, kidney stones, there is almost always going to be a diagnostic test that's going to confirm the presence of a kidney stone, and it's going to be some form of a radiographic imaging study. And so with claims data, which is essentially what we're using with Medicare and with Optum, we can look at how imaging testing is utilized among patients with kidney stones. And that's exactly what we did. And we wanted to understand, you know, if we broke the imaging tests into different categories, you know, so we broke them into CT imaging, plain X-ray imaging, such as a KUB exam, ultrasound, and then tests that we knew would be less commonly utilized, but still would be interesting to look at. And that would be things like intravenous pyelography and magnetic resonance imaging. And we wanted to understand over time how or have practice patterns changed. And so as we looked at the imaging data, I think both in Medicare and in Optum, you know, there are several striking findings. And if we initially will restrict our discussion just to the adult population, and what we found was that CT imaging for both the working age population as well as the over 65 population, the Medicare cohort, CT imaging was by far the most commonly utilized imaging study for patients with stone disease, about much greater than ultrasound, for example, is utilized almost twice as often, actually, as ultrasound was. So really, in the United States, CT imaging is the cornerstone or foundation imaging test for stone formers. After CT imaging, the second most commonly utilized is actually plain radiography. It's not ultrasound. Ultrasound is the third most commonly utilized test. And all of the data we're sharing today, they reside in the in a compendium, and that's available on the NIDDK's website. It's very easy to find. You can just put in a browser search bar, NIDDK Urologic Diseases in America. It'll take you to the site, and there's an expanded compendium that presents all of these data and other data. But as you look at the charts and figures associated with imaging, you'll see the lines are really very flat. CT imaging is the most commonly utilized, followed by plain radiography, followed by ultrasound. And it's not really changing over time. And that's probably disappointing to many of us because we know that less exposure to ionizing radiation is better, you know, just as a principle. And we know that, you know, at this point, there's likely overutilization of CT imaging for the diagnosis of stones. And there is effort spent on the part of the American Urological Association with, you know, multiple educational initiatives, as well as other groups, you know, trying to grow providers' comfort with ultrasound as an imaging modality. And we just haven't yet seen traction of it in the adult population. And again, you know, we're using CT imaging twofold greater than we are using ultrasound imaging. And now again, you know, our data stopped in the mid 2010s. And so, you know, as we hope to, with Urologic Disease in America, look at more recent data, you know, one hope is that we may start to see an inflection point with increased utilization of ultrasound. Now, as we talked about in the prevalence discussion that we looked at the pediatric population, we also looked at the pediatric population when it came to diagnostics. And this was, I think, a little bit of a more happier story, if you will, or more satisfying story, meaning that we did actually see that although at the initial years we studied, so in the mid-2000s, CT was utilized quite commonly, ultrasound had a very positive slope, meaning that ultrasound was increased in utilization and eventually became more commonly utilized than CT. So in the pediatric cohorts, we are seeing a movement away from CT as the dominant imaging modality. And so, you know, our hope is that as, you know, further educational initiatives, training efforts are brought out to the urologic community, that we will see in the adult population perhaps a movement away from CT towards ultrasound as a as you know kind of the more of a mainstay or staple diagnostic modality. And then moving from diagnostic to actual the therapeutics, you know, Ryan, I'll ask you to share you know your thoughts on the therapies for patients with stone disease.
Right. Yeah. And thanks, Brian. I think one of the values of one of the things that we get from these types of claims-based data is we get a pretty confident estimate of the surgeries that are produced for kidney stone disease. As you know, primarily these are going to be shockwave lithotripsy, ureteroscopy, and percutaneous stone procedures. And overall, what we saw was that surgical procedures for kidney stone disease increased overall during this time period. But the percentage of kidney stone patients undergoing surgery has declined. And so, and you know, we'll get to this later, and that some patients will get second procedures or second stage procedures. And you know, this may reflect also improved surgical outcomes, or it may reflect that perhaps that we are observing more stones than we used to. And we also found that there was a trend towards more ambulatory surgery and ambulatory care. And among the ambulatory surgeries performed, there was an overall rise in ureteroscopy utilization and less reliance in shockwave lithotripsy. In fact, ureteroscopy has now become the dominant stone procedure overall. And there may be different reasons for this. You know, as we know, the AUA guidelines include all three techniques, but ureteroscopy seems to be very versatile for most stone sizes and locations. And during the same time period, we know that there's been many improvements in technique, newer generation ureteroscopes, newer lasers, advances in baskets and other disposable tools and sheaths. We also found that percutaneous nephrolithotomy was relatively a stable in utilization across these time periods. So not very, very uncommonly used, approximately 1% of all stone patients. And as expected, most of these, the percutaneous nephrolithotomy procedures were performed in the outpatient setting. We did start to see some more and more ambulatory procedures performed. Although, again, this was the vast majority were shockwave lithotripsy and ureteroscopy procedures.
Yeah, and that's what really struck me as well, is that just the, how in the United States, especially as we compare it to other you know healthcare systems across the globe, percutaneous nephrolithotomy is really a very seldomly performed procedure. And it gets back into, I know the group from Michigan has looked at this years ago of you know the idea that is there some even centralization or regionalization of care when it comes to you know, that the procedures such as percutaneous nephrolithotomy. And you know what we found when we look in the pediatric population was also analogous to the adult population, that ureteroscopy was also the dominant form of surgical therapy. And I you know certainly was surprised by that. it's classic, almost dogma, that we learn as we go through training, that children tend to do very well, even perhaps better than adults, when treated with shockwave lithotripsy. And certainly, the AUA's surgical management of stones guidelines document, when you look at the source data for it, that's, was reinforced by those source data also. But when you actually look at what is the clinical practice, ureteroscopy is utilized more commonly in that pediatric population. It could be, as you said, Ryan, that, as the technology has increased, scopes are more miniaturized, and plus also that we know from prevalence that it tends to be a condition that manifests more commonly in the teenage years, that, it may be the smaller scopes plus larger children may align better for ureteroscopy. But that was something in the pediatric population that, that certainly struck me. The other therapy, besides surgical therapy, is obviously medical therapy. And as I said at the beginning of the podcast, the great thing of this iteration of the Urologic Disease Project is that we had access to pharmacy benefits information, or essentially pharmaceutical utilization in the Medicare population and in the Optum population. And so as we look at what pharmacotherapies are used for stone disease, I'll be clear, there are some challenges in that data set. For example, we know that certain agents like thiazide diuretics may be used for medical therapy, for example, for patients with hypercalciuria. But those agents are also used for as a blood pressure control agent. So we weren't really able to get data about some types of medical therapies associated with stone disease because there is some contamination of the data. But there are other agents that we are able to get, especially when they're prescribed around the time of a stone event. And those agents that I thought were particularly interesting as we looked at were alpha blockers and then opioid agents. And we'll talk about the alpha blockers first. And so our data went from 2006 up to 2013. And what we found over that period is that corresponds to the time when there is emerging evidence that utilization of alpha blockers may promote the passage of certain ureteral stones. Now, we know now at present, based on two well-performed randomized controlled trials, one from United States, one from United Kingdom, that really, I think fairly convincingly have shown us that alpha blockers are not effective in medical expulsive therapy. But if we look at these data, this was in a time before those randomized controlled trials existed, we saw that there was progressive increase in utilization of alpha blocker agents prescribed in the setting of a stone event. And so these were obviously agents that were utilized for, or likely agents that were used for medical expulsive therapy. Presumably, if we were to now carry the data into 2020, we would see hopefully a decline in utilization, which again reflects, what the clinical evidence tells us. But I think that's, a very interesting question for the next data review for the urologic diseases in America as we look at stone disease again. But I think the more striking medication agent that is prescribed in the setting of a stone event is opioids. Obviously, no news to any of us who live in the United States that there is a opioid epidemic, if you want to term it that, but there's really great utilization of opioid agents in a problematic way in this country. And it's made us turn our attention to just how are we using these agents in the treatment of patients with conditions such as stone disease, where we know there is pain associated with it. And what we found is that opioids are by far the most commonly utilized agent for adult stone formers, both in the Medicare population as well as in the Optum population, the privately insured cohort. And it's a positive slope, unfortunately, in both groups, that each year there's greater utilization of opioid agents than there was in the year previous to it. And so this is obviously a very concerning trend, I think, to all of us in the urologic community. And it really points out an area, and again, we'll talk about this in the take-home message, but this is an area where probably we can take away some point from this, that there's a way to improve the care we're delivering, to move away from this really tremendous utilization of opioid agents that we've found among stone formers. When we look at the pediatric population, again, the pediatric population hopefully is a bit of a bellwether in all of this, because we do see that although there is high utilization of opioids in the pediatric population, that it has somewhat stabilized and maybe beginning to decline. So similar to how the pediatric population seems to have taken up the mantle of ultrasound as a diagnostic earlier than in the adult population, our hope is that with this opioid, that it's also, we start to see trends away from utilization of these agents among the stone formers. I think then, now this brings us to a good point. We've talked about diagnostics, we've talked about therapeutics, and then, really the next discussion is what about outcomes of treatment? And so, Brian, I'll let you share with what you found about treatment outcomes.
Great. Brian, as you mentioned before, I think the value of these data sets is that we can assess the effectiveness of kidney stone management over time. And so a couple points that I found interesting was that that not only do people get diagnostics and treatment, but they get multiple episodes of treatment and care over time. So for example, between 2009 and 2013, 70% of kidney stone patients had at least one imaging study, but up to 5% had 10 to 19 of these imaging studies. Another example is that about a third or 30% of patients between 2009 and 2013 had at least one ER visit, but many had more. 7% had two, and 3% had three or more ER visits. And so we get to see these trends and potentially who is at risk. We also get data on retreatment rates, and we talked about surgeries and procedures earlier. But what we found that retreatment for kidney stone procedures was most commonly observed after PCNL. This, I think, was expected. Oftentimes, we do second look procedures, and this is often planned after PCNL. And I think many people would get CT scans while patients are hospitalized overnight to look for residual fragments. But I think what was really striking about this data was that there were very high retreatment rates after shockwave lithotripsy and ureteroscopy. And so for ureteroscopy, this was about 26% retreatment rate within 120 days. And this was about 32% for ureteroscopy within 120 days. Not quite sure what's driving these high retreatment rates. We know that both procedures have residual fragments. There's a risk for that, and that the literature suggests that the outcomes of ureteroscopy are superior than shockwave lithotripsy. So we would have expected less retreatment for ureteroscopy, and so this may be because that perhaps urologists are increasingly treating more complex stones through ureteroscopy for the reasons mentioned before, as it's a versatile procedure. Or maybe there's a publication by some prior studies, and this is the true, what we're really seeing in practice.
Yeah, I think, that really captures, the essence of it when we talk about the outcomes. And, the great thing with these administrative data sets is we can begin to identify patterns, such as what you just described. And then, as we start to peel back the layers, to try to then understand what do the patterns reflect, and we lose some granularity, and that, then brings us to kind of the next set of questions, if you will, that can be answered. And I think that's a very natural segue into, kind of what our thoughts, at least, are some of the take-home messages. And I'm sure anyone who's listening will have other thoughts too. And I would encourage anyone to go to the NIDDK website to actually download the compendium. It's just a large PDF, but it's really incredibly comprehensive and has way more data than, what we're able to share in a 20-minute podcast episode. And that's something I think that, you know, again, as I see the value of urologic diseases, one of its roles is to help identify what are the questions that we want to ask. You know, I think Ryan, you know, you and I can just go through a couple points. You know, one thing that struck me, I'll just throw this out there to begin with, is that, you know, we're using ionizing radiation to a really great extent among stone formers. And that probably is an opportunity for whether it's process improvement or care pathway improvement. But some, you know, I would say that in an ideal world, something should shift and we should start to see increasing utilization of a modality such as ultrasound and perhaps decreasing utilization of something like CT. Ryan, what would your thoughts be on another area of interest that struck you?
I thought this the UDA data sets and this effort really helps shine the light on the burden of disease. And I think you know, also in this data set that we didn't have a chance to mention is some of the costs. So not only the burden and the prevalence of disease, but also the cost burdens. I also think that we saw not only in the adult and pediatric population that there was a rise in the dominance of ureteroscopy over time over shockwave lithotripsy and percutaneous nephrolithotomy.
Yeah, and that's, you know, really something that's remarkable. And then when you start to break it down into the other populations, you know, especially in the pediatric population where really ureteroscopy has replaced shockwave as the, you know, treatment of choice, it seems. But yet that hasn't yet been reflected in the literature. And it's just, as you said, Ryan, you know, there may be a publication bias towards that or perhaps something else driving it. You know, one other factor that struck me was the utilization of opioids, you know, and this is likely a phenomenon of the United States. You know, I think if there's international listeners, you know, this probably won't resonate as much, but certainly to, you know, all urologists who practice in the United States, that we're, you know, there's a tremendous utilization, probably over-utilization, to be honest, of opioids for stone formers. And that's, again, you know, an opportunity for care improvement, you know, going forward.
I also thought that it was interesting that the retreatment rates were really much higher than I had expected. And I think what we're seeing is practice patterns and outcomes across the United States, not just at, you know, what we see in publications. And this is what's really happening in the real world, that up to a third of patients after ureteroscopy and shockwave lithotripsy have a retreatment within 120 days. I thought that was remarkable.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and so then, you know, we've kind of been discussing what, you know, the Urologic Diseases Project is a really tremendous project. It's, you know, very visionary by the NIDDK to support it. And, you know, what are the goals of the project? And I think it's to really create, one, an awareness of what is, as you termed it, the burden of disease. And then also, what are opportunities where care can be improved, where questions can be asked? You know, it helps with some of the genesis of discovery in the field, which ultimately, you know, leads to improved outcomes for our patients. And I think that, you know, we've highlighted just a couple of areas, and it's really, you know, very much scratching the surface of areas that could inform, you know, future projects, grant proposals, you know, that are really going to have meaningful changes to, you know, actually how care is being delivered, not at expert centers of excellence, which just tends to be what we see in publications, but rather at, you know, really what's going on a day-to-day basis in the urologic community with regards to treatment. And, you know, one of my goals with urologic diseases in America is to have this serve as, you know, essentially the reference point for that, scope of the problem question that always comes up in a grant application. And so, you know, I think that as, you know, as the listeners, hopefully you go to the compendium and, you know, kind of peel back a few more layers of the project, you can see what those data are and what opportunities for questions exist. I'd like to, before I close it out, Ryan, do you have any other closing thoughts?
No, Brian, thank you for including me. I think, you know, this really motivates me to think of other projects and to address some of these treatment gaps. So thank you for including me.
Yeah, and Ryan, thank you very much for being a part of this project. It's you've been a great opportunity to work with you. And, you know, I'd of course, you know, like to thank Dr. Kevin Abbott, Dr. Zia Kirkali, Dr. Tamara Bevendum from the NIDDK, who, you know, have supported with their leadership and vision this project. And Lydia Feinstein, Julia Ward from Social Scientific Systems, who provided you know, all the analytic support for this project. You know, it's obviously a large, heavy lift, and there's lots of people that worked on it. And then, of course, you know, I think one of the great successes in the past year with the Urologic Diseases in America project is our partnership with the American Urological Association in supporting our efforts to disseminate these findings, you know, to really broadcast them to the urologic community through podcasts and, you know, forums at various meetings. And that's something that the American Urological Association has been a tremendous partner with us for. And so I just want to thank the UA for that. And I hope this was a informative 20 or so minutes that you spent with us. And again, you know, if there's questions or interest from this, I would encourage you to go to the NIDDK website, look at the compendia for this, for stone disease, as well as BPH, urinary incontinence, you know, the other conditions we've discussed through prior podcasts. And then there'll be other urologic conditions coming to that website as well. So again, it's easy to find just on any search bar. If you type in NIDDK, Urologic Diseases in America, it'll be the first link that pops up. So thank you again for joining us, and I hope this was informative.